Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today.
Welcome. My name is Anne Wilson, and it is my pleasure to host the Emerge Australia podcast series being brought to you in Long COVID Awareness Week 2026. This year, as in past years, I have the pleasure to interview clinicians and researchers from all over the world whose critical work is dedicated to ME/CFS, Long COVID, and infection-associated chronic illnesses. I acknowledge the traditional custodians of country and their connections to land, sea, and community, and I pay my respect to elders past and present, noting their continuing contributions, struggles, and achievements. As we continue to reflect on the magnificent lyrics of John Lennon's Imagine, I can't help but imagine a world where the brotherhood of man is celebrated globally. And for our listeners, a world without stigma or discrimination, a world where we have equity of access to treatments, clinical services, and of course, cures. I think that's something not only worth imagining, but actually visualizing and making happen. So today, it's my pleasure to welcome to you Associate Professor Bernard Hsu, head of the Geelong Long COVID and ME/CFS Clinic and also the Newport Long COVID and ME/CFS Clinics here in Victoria. Bernard, you are recognised as a leader in this field, and without going into too much of your background, I just would love it if you tell us a little bit about your clinical expertise and research focus, the work that you do in Victoria, in particular around long COVID, and the awards that your clinic and you personally have achieved as a result of being named RACGP Clinician of the Year and your practice likewise. So welcome, Bernard, and really looking forward to hearing from you. So let's go.
Thank you, Anne. Thank you for the opportunity for me to speak to the wider audience and hopefully bringing together clinicians, policymakers, and patients together to advance the care for patients suffering from these conditions, especially long COVID and ME/CFS that we are talking about today. And these two conditions are best understood as overlapping conditions on a spectrum of what we call the post-infectious energy-limiting conditions or energy-limiting disease. And clinically, they do share a lot of core features that are quite common. For example, the post-exertional malaise, cognitive dysfunctions, autonomic instability, and including their sleep and also immune system can be dysregulated. And these conditions tend to have very similar presentation, although patients don't come in and tell us all these symptoms, and they will come in with one or two of these and start helping us to understand, maybe they do have one or more of these conditions. And long COVID has been around since maybe about 2 years after the pandemic has started. But in many ways, it forced the whole medical system to maybe confront what people with ME/CFS have been experiencing for decades. And my work and my clinics see that the interface between the clinical care, education, research, and even sometimes a policy system design. In practice, sometimes it means taking patients, what patients are actually experiencing, and using it in a structural and longitudinal way to help us to understand the condition a bit better. And at the same time, hopefully our work will close the historical gap by ensuring that patients with ME/CFS and their knowledge will inform our long COVID care, rather than just reinventing the world, but we're actually working together to make a better world in the future. So I guess that's what we do.
Yeah, I mean, that's amazing because you touched on so many areas. I mean, a previous interviewee for this podcast talked about her experiences where the listening was not really done and the understanding, and then taking the patient's experience and working from where the patient's at to looking at, you know, what can be done to help, what didn't happen. And of course, you know, there's been the gaslighting, there's been the medical misogyny where people just really are dismissed because they're not getting any answers and the doctors don't have the answers. So that explanation, I'm sure, is very helpful to many of our listeners. With the recognition of your award for RACGP of the Year, and you've got National GP Practice of the Year, which is pretty cool as far as I'm concerned, what is it that you do to lead to such awards, and how does your approach to patient care and education differ from those traditional models? I mean, at what point did it start for you that you decided I need to do things differently?
First of all, thank you for the recognitions. And it's never really about an individual achievement. And we have a whole clinic approach. Everyone on the team has the same ethos and same mentality and trying to bring a new perspective in managing care to our patients. And it's not just about ME/CFS and long COVID patients, but as a whole of everything that we manage. We focus on continuity. We focus on teamwork. We focus on listening to our patients to make sure they feel safe. We focus a lot on innovations. We want to bring on education to the public and also clinicians. All these are embedded into our everyday, day-to-day practice in our clinic. And it's not just a moment that we wake up and say, hey, let's do this. In fact, from the beginning, when we first set up the clinic over 10 years ago now, and we wanted to do this from the first day. And it's really different from the traditional models because we do not treat complexity as an inconvenience, but in fact, we design our care around the complexity. So I guess that's the different approach. So that means longer consultations become a common practice for all the clinicians, and quite often spending more than 30 minutes with our patients. We do home visits. We do a lot of shared decision-making process and integrate that with Allied Health to work together as an active program for our patients. And part of that is we invest heavily on teaching and to make our practice and the teaching practice to be a reflective one, which means we continue to learn from the data that we collect, our day-to-day practice, and make it useful for future research process and also on a day-to-day care to improve the outcome of the patient. To me, I think excellence is not just about really doing more medicine, but doing medicine in a way that's holistic and thoughtful, and also to create an impact to a patient's everyday journey.
Amazing.
The way how we do things may be slightly different than other clinics, and we're glad that it's being recognized as hoping that more clinics can follow the way how we do things.
I mean, that's amazing. As you were speaking, I was just wondering, is that any comparative data being able to be gathered on the patients, let's say ME/CFS and long COVID patients who come to your clinic and the outcomes that they obtain from, let's say, other areas of the state or country to see, you know, to be able to demonstrate that your approach really works?
So we actually presented data in a long COVID conference in the last 2 years. So we have managed over 1,000 complex community patients, and we discharge 90% of those patients back to the GPs to continue to manage. So we describe ourselves as a specialist clinic. We're not GP clinic. So we help the GPs or patients' GP to continue to manage. From time to time, patients check in with us, but most of the work is actually still done by the GP. Only about 10% of those patients will be kept on our book. We'll continue to look after them. Most of them actually get discharged. So perhaps it is partially the nature of the condition. They do wax away, they do get better, and then they will be able to continue to travel with their own GP. But at the same time, it could be we have a very good team of people that set up a good protocol, and the patients are able to continue with the help of their GP.
That's really interesting, because you're talking about people getting better. I would think that there'd be a lot of people with ME/CFS, and I know we're talking about long COVID here, but there'd be a lot of people with ME/CFS who would say, but what about me? I don't get better. And the other question I just wanted to ask was, what about, are you finding you've got people from all over the state or country trying to contact you to be seen either via telemedicine, et cetera? Or is it just in your geographic area?
Yeah, the two things that you mentioned about, one is better, and that is a very good question, because that definition of what we call the goals of care, what kind of goals that you want to set, and has to be tailored to the patients. One person may say that, well, I really want to finish my marathon training as their goal. Another person to say that I just want to walk my dog down the convenience shop and back without feeling lousy. So we really need to have that sort of mentality with other clinicians and allied health to be on the same page. Where are we at to help the patients to understand what they want to achieve? And getting better is when they can achieve their goals. Not our goals, it has your patient's goals.
Yeah.
If they want to climb the Mount Everest, we'll meet them there. We just have to make sure that the medications are there, and I just want to make sure that allied health is helping them. But at the same time, we need to be realistic what can be done. So the education to help the patient understand what can be achieved in what time frame is very, very important. So that means they have a good understanding of when they can do more, when they can do less, when they need to pace themselves, when they can help us to understand they're struggling. So that's the better bit, is about better understanding what they're going through.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, that leads me on to looking at what kind of support do GPs need, and what kind of almost role modeling do they need in order to be able to, A, understand the holistic nature of your practice and a practice that delivers results for this very challenging group of patients, and what is it that you yourself are doing about that?
You mentioned about different patients seeking care coming from different states to come to our clinic, and yes, we do have increasingly more from New South Wales and South Australia coming to our clinic, and those patients travel for 12 hours, 15 hours to come to seek care. And it's starting to become more common. We're not getting a lot from Queensland. This is really a bit too far for them, or other states. And recently, we've been contacted by clinicians in the UK and Singapore, Japan, to get more advice from us. Not direct patients care, but we are helping those clinicians that want to learn a little bit more how our model of care different from their countries, their system. So the main challenges that we see, really, most of the GPs just struggle with time. They just don't have enough time to spend with the patient, really to listen to them and really just be present with the patient, just be there and hold that space and see what we can do. And most of them just struggle with that. And also because of their confidence, because a lot of them don't see a lot of these patients or don't manage enough number of these patients to say that they are confident enough to know what to do next, what investigation to do, and when to do what. And this comes from a historical learning gap or training gaps, medical school to specialist training that we are not teaching enough ME/CFS or energy limiting condition to our trainees. And less more for the, even less for the post-viral syndromes, and add on to the workload and pressures and the rapidly evolving evidence that they don't know which one they listen to. And it is probably understandable that becomes quite an uncertainty for many of our colleagues to go down which path and to learn more about these conditions.
Yeah.
It's not really about just giving them information or setting up a website or even sending them a webinar to listen to. It has to be more structured. It has to be more about case-based discussions. It has to have a very clear clinical framework for them to go by, and perhaps even decision-making tools to help them to understand about these conditions. And very importantly, to reassure them that their uncertainty doesn't mean that they are incompetent.
Yes,
just the reality of these conditions are very hard to manage. And our colleagues need to feel supported and not judged, and when managing these very complex conditions. And we are hoping in our college with our new special interest group, hopefully we can deliver this part of the education to our colleagues and really support them to embark on this journey with the patients.
Yeah, I mean, that was going to be the next thing, because you are the inaugural chair of the SCGP Energy Living and Living and Conditions and Post-Infection Disease Working Group. And so my next question was going to be, do you see that as being a catalyst to maybe creating that change and maybe overseeing some changes that would happen, let's say, at the tertiary level for undergraduates? Because it certainly appears that level of information and, you know, case-based training, real examples seems to be missing from that curriculum.
I completely agree, because there's a lot of fragmentations in the process. And quite often, patients fall between different specialties and different clinicians, and they don't know who to see for the symptoms that they're getting. It's just because the education is not a longitudinal one, and the rheumatologist will deal with part of it, and the cardiologist will deal with part of it. And quite often, it's fall back to the primary care to manage and oversee the whole for all picture. And unfortunately, that training is a bit hit and miss at the moment, and causing, like I said, the lack of confidence and not enough time on top of that, and not enough support. And that becomes something that we need to address. And hoping the special interest group will be able to do step by step, a little by little bit. And over the next few years, that we'll be able to establish a good framework and how to approach this a bit better. It is an opportunity that we can open up and change the management significantly. And this momentum hopefully starts from the, as you know, the political attention that recently that we get, and the research funding that government is willing to allocate for the long COVID research. And of course, the different area of the professional engagement with other specialties, and that we didn't have before. Now we have a dialogue with all these different allied health and specialists to work together. And this task hopefully will embed a knowledge into the mainstream of undergraduate teaching, all the way to different specialist teaching, and especially in general practice and family medicine training as well, to make sure that ME/CFS and long COVID are not sidelined again. We have to build this sustainable education model, and working together with research and policy that is at the government level that persists beyond the pandemic. And that will be our.
Absolutely. Just going back a little bit, a lot of the calls that we get at Emerge Australia, whether it's from people with ME/CFS, long COVID, or other energy limiting conditions, often put us in the place of service coordination. And so your clinic seems to pride itself on having a multidisciplinary team with the patient, you know, a patient-centered multidisciplinary team. How important and what emphasis do you see government can help to put on to help GPs be able to focus on the need for a multidisciplinary team? Because often what ends up happening is the patient who hasn't got any energy and feels dreadful has to coordinate, you know, information back to their GP from half a dozen different clinicians, and they just can't do it. It falls apart. So, you know, how important is it from your perspective to be able to look at that multidisciplinary team as an absolute essential vehicle for supporting the patient?
Yeah, questions. These conditions that we manage, they present in so many different ways that throw us into surprise from time to time. And they don't always come in to say, hey, Bernard, I got long COVID. They don't.
Not the
positive. I got this headache, won't go away. Or they got this cough that has been there for months. So we really have to have all our technical ups to be able to say, wait, hang on, maybe we're looking at something very different. And the government has a role to play in enabling this process by investing into a few things. Number one is having services, having clinics that cater for conditions like these, especially those that are more severe spectrum that we cannot manage in primary care, that we have a place that we know we can fall back to. So there are specialists that we can maybe ring up or maybe send an email to, or maybe even send to their clinic to help us to manage them better in the primary care setting. But sometimes we just need that extra little bit of that, well, I'm not too sure, can you double check for us? So that would help in terms of government putting extra funding or resources to set up these services, which also leads to another problem or another advancement that the government can do is about workforce planning.
Yes.
So these need to be funded properly and also has to be staffed properly with the specialists that have this special interest or the research capability to help the patient to take them to the next step. And that workforce support and planning requires a lot of oversight from higher up. And that is something that the government can help. And the last thing is to put all this into data and doing research and translation science to make the research very quickly be implemented into clinical care. So mixing all three together, patients will be able to access really good evidence-based care, both in the primary care and also when necessary, go to hospital care. And also the clinician will feel they are supported, be that with their resources, with their time and education, so that they can give the care that they want to their patients. And that the whole system needs to be rethinked and how to approach it in a different way. And I think government has a lot of opportunity to help us to make this better. And hopefully that makes sense.
It does make sense. Did the changes to the MBS item for long consultations help at all?
Yeah, for those of us that function in these spaces that will find long consultations are the norm, because we absolutely need to listen to the patients, and because they are so complex, and if we don't take the time, quite often we just miss some very vital information. And having that extra rebate will help us to support our patients a bit better instead of rushing them or bringing them back for another consultation. But we can book a longer consultation time with them so that we can lay it all down and have a very good plan for them. Many of these patients can't just keep coming in to see us because they are limited by their resources themselves, including their energy level. So it is better have that opportunity while they are already in our clinic to do all that necessary for them. So having that longer consultation rebate certainly helps the patients to travel longer in their journey.
Has telemedicine been an asset? Has it helped? Or, you know, is it still critical that the patients come in?
Yeah, telemedicine absolutely helped, especially for reviewing patients when they are well. because it saved their journey. They don't have to come in. And sometimes it's very short to say, how's it going? How's the new medication going? Or to review some of the investigation with them. Hey, your blood test seems to be showing your improvement, or an X-ray or CT to say that, hey, the CT is clear. Let's not go down that path. Let's go on to another path. So that really helps to save a lot of time and also the anxiousness of them waiting to come in to see us. What telehealth or telemedicine cannot do is it cannot examine the patient, or if the patient starts to get worse and that doesn't work, and we still need to see the patient face to face.
We've got to examine them. Yeah, I get it. I just was wondering about that. So is there any particular patient case or research finding that influenced your approach to patient care or sparked a new research direction maybe 10 years ago that you said, right, this has got to be the way we go? Because, you know, I think there would be a lot of people listening to this who go, I wish my GP thought like that. I wish my GP had a similar approach. Was there a defined moment for you?
I think it works hand in hand. So my clinical work constantly informs my research priorities, because every case that I see a pattern. The more cases I see more patterns that emerge very quickly that help me to say, wait, hang on, you know, I see 10 patients. Out of that, 8 of them have this. Maybe we should look into this a little bit closer. So my clinical work helps me to refine my research capability and priorities. But at the same time, once the research data started to come out, then I can reshape my clinical approach. When I start seeing that, hey, there are more papers coming out to say that this particular medications or this particular approach actually works, and I can quickly translate that into the clinical practice and help the patients to get better quicker. So it works hand in hand in that way. So almost every meaningful research direction I pursued began with listening carefully to the patient. So that's why it is the patient is actually teaching me what to do and helping me to understand the whole science behind these conditions.
Yes, yes. Our former medical director, Dr. Richard Schloeffel, always used to say that he learns the most from his patients.
That's right, yes.
And I think that, you know, that's so true. So one of the challenges, we know that we've got a federal government that allocated $50 million to long COVID research, which, you know, is amazing. That was now nearly 2 years ago. And, you know, each year there are, you know, proposals coming from left, right and centre to the MRFF to fund all sorts of research projects. As with all medical research, the major challenge is when is it going to translate into something that patients can benefit from? Have you got a view about the kind of research that is funded and, you know, just the importance of translational medicine so that patients can finally get a grip on some of these potentially exciting developments that seem to take the next 20 years to come to fruition?
I think it's encouraging to see that the government finally has accepted how important it is to do proper research in long COVID. And hopefully the outcome of that research will help patients with ME/CFS, as we started from the beginning talking about how many of these symptoms actually overlap. So it is exciting for researchers and a clinician like myself and seeing this being unfold. However, research is still just research and just publication. And how do we translate that on a day-to-day practice? It still starts from that interaction with the patients. And I normally start with a very small change in the practice with testable that change that we can actually measure. And then we share the learning through small group discussions and sometimes through teaching sessions with our juniors as well. And then we collect the evidence and we embed those evidence into a workflows so that in our clinic, we can quickly use those in our patients when they come in. So rather than we expect every single clinician to remember everything, we try to streamline this whole process. And that means we need to produce a lot of guidelines, and these guidelines need to be updated pretty quickly. We have plenty of case discussion process, and we have WhatsApp group, we have Signal groups that set up so that we can share our learning very quickly. And we like to have co-consult models. That means Allied Health or other specialists who come to our clinic and sit with us together. Sometimes it can be through video, sometimes it could be face-to-face. So that would be GP together with a neurologist seeing the patient together. So that's the co-consulting models. And then we have this feedback that constantly getting patients to tell us what they are experiencing together with the clinician and researchers, collecting this information and very quickly adjust what we are researching and how we input those data into the equations. The key is really about relevance. Okay. If this evidence does not help a GP on a very busy Monday morning clinic, they're not going to use it. So make sure that it's relevant enough and impactful enough that they can actually use it next Monday.
No, absolutely agree. I want to just shift it a little bit and talk to you about the repurposing of drugs from one disease area to another. There's a little bit of research happening, a lot of research happening in the US around various drugs. What do you see as the opportunities in Australia? Are there any particular drugs that might show promise if they were able to be repurposed for clinical trials in ME/CFS?
Another very good question. In fact, special interest group is preparing a session just to talk about that. And off-label prescribing to quickly translating research medications into practice even before TGA approval. How do we approach this practice safely? To be honest, in medicine, not just in the conditions that we're talking about, we do that quite often, use medications in other fields into the field that we are talking about. It is a common practice, and we do need to have that sort of governance and evidence-based principle behind, because quite often, to be honest, these patients are quite desperate.
Yeah.
And the clinicians are also quite desperate, and they see something that is on the market or it's just been published by a journal, and they really want to use it because they're hoping these medication can bring a difference and to their patients. And the principle still behind it is we have to go with evidence. So evidence-based practice is still the way that we want to encourage our clinicians to follow. Same thing with our patients. And quite easily, we alluded to something that is just looks so good, sounds so good, but quite often they're just too good to be true. So we know that you need to have a team of good clinicians, especially those that have this background, guide the patients appropriately at the right time to use the right medications.
Yes.
And that is the key.
Yes. So I'm now going to move to antivirals because the prescribing of antivirals for people with COVID limits them to people 70 years and over or people that are frail, have got, you know, autoimmune or they're immune compromised states, etc. It seems to me that that's an area that requires some change.
The college and myself have been advocating on this point for, two and a half years now. And I remember going to Canberra trying to convince the minister about how we should loosen up the restrictions on giving out the antiviral, especially those patients that we know well, and they would do well by having those antiviral medications. But after 2.5 years, I have to say we have not been too successful in changing their mind. And we are not going to stop. We want them to continue to listen to us. That antivirals does make a difference in terms of trajectory of the patients getting very severe symptoms or developing long COVID conditions. There's been many, many papers that published talking about how important they are. And I'm still hopeful that one day the government will listen to the evidence and really help the patients to access this very, very useful medication early.
Yeah, that then brings me to the question of prevention. Of course, you know, the best way to prevent getting long COVID is to not get COVID in the first place.
Exactly,
but
yes.
There are so many people who've already had it, and there are so many questions around, should I get vaccinated? What is the impact of the vaccination? What considerations does my doctor need to look at before suggesting vaccination to me? And, you know, there are many people who are just cynical, skeptical, etc. You know, we're going to be coming into Australia's cold season, end of autumn, beginning of winter and winter, etc. What are your thoughts on vaccination, and particularly for people who've already got ME/CFS or long COVID, and what are the risks, the real risks for those people?
I think the decision has to be a shared decision with their treating clinicians. It cannot be a one-sided decision, and it cannot be a one-size-fits-all answer either. There are times that we want to separate the vaccines, having one vaccine first and then another one. And so the timing of those vaccines are important. And yes, there have been sporadic but significant reports to say that patients after vaccination, be that COVID vaccines or flu vaccine, they have a flare-up of their ME/CFS symptoms. And that's true. And that does happen. And it's not something that we cannot manage. We just need to anticipate if that was going to happen, how are we going to manage that? Just like any other flare-up, any other episodes of ME/CFS flare-up, if we anticipate and get ready for it, it actually will be a lot easier to manage. Imagining if they didn't have the vaccine, they actually contracted the real virus, and their outcome will be a lot worse than actual vaccination itself. And that's the message that we need to make it quite clear. So the vaccination, yes, very minor amount of patient, number of patients can get their ME/CFS symptoms flare up, but their flare up will be a lot worse if they were actually getting the virus themselves. So that's why we are still strongly advocating, if possible, have a good chat with your GP about when and which vaccine to get. And that's important. I can see that a lot of patients are becoming quite complacent about the COVID vaccine, and we still are encouraging, if you are healthy, you should still get your COVID vaccine at least once a year to get updated because of the variants. Variants means, if you remember, these terms we don't talk about anymore is the Alpha group, the Delta group, the Omicron group, because they do change and they do evolve into a newer strand. The older generation of the vaccine will not work as well as the new version of the vaccine. And that's why we still recommend you, if you are getting your flu jabs, why not as well get the COVID jab at the same time? It's once a year and get it done. And that would be the most ideal approach. Of course, like I said, everyone is slightly different. Some patients may need every 6 months. Some patients need only every 12 months. So have a good chat with your treating GPs or treating clinician will be the most ideal way of managing this.
Yeah. Is it wise to have a flu shot and a COVID jab at the same time?
I mean, if you are healthy and no other conditions, and if you have had a discussion with your GP, it is absolutely encourageable to do both at the same time, and you are allowed to do that. Those patients that have ME/CFS, probably less encourageable to have them on the same day, we'll definitely advise them at least to have 2 weeks apart. The COVID first or the flu jab first, and then have the other one 2 weeks later.
Yeah. Because it is difficult, Bernard. I must say that with some of the GP education that Emerge Australia has done, talking to GPs at GPCE or at Health Ed, I mean, we still get a lot of GPs who come and say, look, COVID's over, it's finished. You know, don't have to worry about that anymore. And that's really discouraging.
Well, we still have a lot of work to do, don't we? And so we'll continue to help our colleagues to understand about the reality of these conditions. And it's definitely not over. Just because you don't hear on the media doesn't mean that it's not there. You look at the data collected from the hospital, the data looking at from last year to this year, COVID certainly is still around. And and we still need to be very vigilant, especially those that have chronic conditions, COPD, asthma, NDCFS. They all will suffer a lot more when they contract the virus again.
Yeah, absolutely. Just an aside, we are working at Emerge Australia with the Safer Air Project that is looking at ventilation, you know, for buildings, for hospitals, etc. I mean, that seems to be an emerging area of interest that we need to look at as well as vaccination. Have you got any thoughts on that?
I think, if anything, I think the pandemic has taught us a lot more about things that we don't usually talk about. And these are air particles, the size of these nanoparticles that, you know, in medical school, we hardly ever talk about. Now we know how important this filter is, how important having an air filter like the one that I have next to me, how important that is. And some of the clinics are more proactive in terms of installing these air filters in each individual rooms that patient facing. And obviously, the hospitals are upgrading their system and checking their filters on a pretty regular basis. And some clinics still need a little bit more time to adjust to that. And we want to encourage our colleagues to look into that earlier than later, because we're not just protecting the patient, we are also protecting our staff and our doctors. We don't want them to get sick. Now, having this filter certainly will help to filter out not just about COVID, but all other potential viruses, pollens, or any other particles that can make people sick. So it is important to look into that, and each clinic will have to decide which model is better for them.
Yeah. Well, one of the areas that we're also looking at is, you know, the household. Given that kids go to school, they come home, bring their bags home, and then mum gets sick, then dad gets sick, then the kids get better, then it all goes round and round again. So clean air is critical, obviously, for the household as well. So we're going to be doing a bit of work in that area as well. Last and final question, Bernard. What would your message be to our Minister, Mark Butler, about top three priorities that we need addressed for ME/CFS in Australia and long COVID?
I think the first thing Mr. Butler needs to know is that patients' symptoms are real and their experience needs to be validated. And their process cannot be done just by the doctors, but also by the government, starting from the ministers, will really be helpful to help them to know that they are not suffering alone. And I don't want the patient to feel dismissed or unheard. And that failure is coming from the system. And we can do our bit as clinicians, but we also need the government to help us to do it. Their message will go a long way to make sure that patients will not feel they being isolated. The second bit would be the message to the clinicians by allocating more resources in the hospital, in the primary care and research setting to help us to fight this, to help us to feel we are not alone as clinicians as well. And that will be extremely helpful. And these messages will set aside as the international leaders in managing these conditions. And we want Australia to be bright star that people look to say, wow, you know, look at how Australia is leading the way in treating these conditions or setting the best guidelines to help patients to get better or having the best resources for the doctors to help the patients. Imagine what it would be like in this working in that sort of government. And I hope the minister will be able to take those credit themselves because they have helped us to help them.
That's amazing. Professor Bernard Shue, thank you so much for your time in your busy day today to come and speak to us at our Long COVID Awareness Week podcast. I thank you on behalf of all of our listeners for making the time to record today. It is greatly appreciated. Today's podcast is part of a clinical series that Emerge Australia has recorded with people of influence. This is a platform where we can together explore the pressing issues faced by 250,000 people with ME/CFS and at least 400,000 more with long COVID in Australia. Tune in again for our next interview, and don't forget, for more information and to subscribe to the Emerge Australia newsletter, visit our website on www.emerge.org.au. Thank you again, Professor Shu, and bye for now.
You may say that I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only